So again, introduction to these arguments. We're hope obviously this is the beginning of a discussion, not the end of it. So we're hoping that this just encourages you to want to think more about arguments for God's existence, and you know, read up on them, and if that interests you. And again, we've got if you go to Rasha Christie's website, we've got a whole pamphlet on Does God Exist. You can get that. It's a different argument. That's one of Aquinas's arguments that Dr. Howe uses in the pamphlet. So if you have questions, you want to talk more about that even afterwards, there's lots of really good arguments for God's existence. But let's say you're talking to somebody, you're using your tactics, you're looking at categories, and you know, you've convinced somebody that God exists. And then the question is, okay, let's say God exists, and there's good arguments like has to be a theistic God, so polytheism is out, and we could talk to you about why we would say that is the case. Philosophically has to be the case, metaphysically has to be the case. So then they're like, okay, fine, which God is it? You know, is it, you know, maybe Islam? Is it Christianity? Is it Judaism? And so we would say, if the Bible is true, then at the center of the Bible is this guy who claimed to be God and said, I'm going to prove it in my death and resurrection, right? And if that is true, anything opposed to it would be false. And so this is a way, because every other religion is about someone telling you about someone that is true, or something is true, right? Christianity is at the core is someone who says, I am the truth. And so that's a great way. So we say we could start with Christianity, because if Christianity is true, then by definition, all of the other religions that oppose to it are false, and we believe the evidence points to that. So let's say you are, if you're talking to a missionary, a Mormon missionary, they come to your door, and you're talking to them about these things, and you're talking about God's existence. But let's say that you get talking about the Bible. Now, for Mormons, they believe the Bible is one of their standard works. So for them, it's the Book of Mormon, it's the Doctrines and Covenants, it's the Pearl of Great Price, and then it's the Bible. And, you know, they sort of lovingly, they give lip service to the fact that they love the Bible, but it really is kind of the lowest of their scriptures, because they believe their eighth article of faith is that it says we believe the Bible as far as it's been translated correctly, and so they teach that, and many of the people, if you talk to them, they'll say, you know, it's kind of like the telephone game. If you ever played the telephone game when you were little, so if I tell David a story, right, I whisper something to his ear, and then he starts, and then it passes it on to everybody and whispers and everything. By the time it gets to Pastor Bob, it's completely different, and we all laugh, and you know, like, haha, that's silly. They would say that's how we have the modern translations of the Bible. So they don't believe that you can trust the Bible, because they also teach in their scriptures, the Book of Mormon says that many plain and precious truths were taken out of the Bible over the years. They believe what's called a great apostasy. So after the apostles died, there was this period where the church went into this great apostasy and all of the truths were lost. That's why there had to be a restoration of the church, and that happened in the 1800s with Joseph Smith. So let's just say you're talking to a missionary, they have that belief about the Bible. You've got 2 minutes to talk to them, so in your groups, how would you try to help to show, help? What questions would you ask, or could you offer anything to them to help them to help them to know what you believe, hopefully, that we do have a good translation or interpretation of the Bible. We do have a good transmission of the text, that we do have what the authors wrote, or maybe if you do believe that. So just take 2 minutes. How would you discuss that with the Mormon missionaries that came to your door? Do you think we can trust the Bible? And remember, for this, we're not necessarily saying, we're not talking about is what it says true. That's what we're talking about next session. We're asking, was the text transmitted properly? Do we have what the authors wrote? Could you be able to give any evidence for that? So take 2 minutes, break up in your groups. What would you say? Ready? Go. Can you just duplicate it to the end? That's what I want to do. I want to keep it. Oh, yeah, cool. Yeah. Oh, yeah, perfect.
All right. Keep going. Yep. And then go back to the top. Perfect.
Okay, all right. I know that's not enough time to kind of to solve the dilemma or even talk about it. But again, just getting you thinking about that, because when our Mormon friends say that we believe the Bible as far as it's been translated correctly, again, historically, the way this argument went, what they really meant was transmitted correctly. And the real question is, have the documents, the originals, been transmitted such that we know that we have an accurate copy of the original New Testament documents? We're only going to focus on the New Testament in this part of our discussion, because in our argument, if the New Testament is true, we can kind of get the Old Testament thrown in for free, because Jesus confirms the New Testament and the Old Testament. So if he's God, then the Old Testament comes in. But we could do another presentation, and certainly David could do a great job of just kind of talking about why we can trust the Old Testament as well. But for our purposes, we would say if we can confirm the New Testament, then the Bible is the Word of God. So here, what we're asking is, we're asking two questions about the Bible, right? We're saying, first, is what I hold here, is that what the authors wrote? And then secondly, is what they wrote true? Both of those have to be true in order for me to be able to trust this book. We'll talk about the first question in this session. David's going to talk about the second question in the next question. So we have to define our terms, right? We have to make sure what do we mean by that? When we talk about the New Testament, is 27 different documents, right? It's not just one book that they got together and self-published on Amazon, in the first century, right? 27 different books. Written on 27 different scrolls, right? They, back then, write on papyrus, they write on vellum, they write on scrolls, right? And those scrolls would eventually fade away, right? They would be overuse. We would lose them, and we'll talk about that in a second. 9 or 10 different authors, depending on who wrote Hebrews, depending on who you think wrote Hebrews, written over about a 20 to 50 different period. Those individual writings have since been collected into one book that we now call the New Testament. So really, the New Testament is not one source, but a collection of sources, right? And the question we're trying to ask is, do we have what the original authors of each of the letter, the epistles, and the gospels in the New Testament, do we have what they wrote? Now, it is true, when we say this to some people, sometimes you get freaked out. In fact, the first time I heard this, I kind of was like, ah, that's scary. We do not have any of the originals of any New Testament document. Again, it was written on parchment and vellum and scrolls, and you use those a lot, and you handle them a lot, and they just disintegrate. We don't have any of the originals. Is that a problem? What I want to try to argue to you tonight is, not only is that not a problem, it could actually be one of the ways in which God used to preserve his word. And so we'll kind of talk about that here at the end. So what do you have? Well, the way that it was done is, let's say David wanted to write, he wanted to write a gospel. So he just pins the whole thing. That is called the autograph, right? That's called the original. Well, that's the original. It's called the autograph. Now, let's say he wants to pass it over to Jeremiah, and Jeremiah says, I really like this. Now, what he couldn't do is just run down to Kinko's, run off 10,000 copies. I can when you say that joke to like younger people, like, what's Kinko's? Like, what are you talking about? Yeah, exactly. Look at Jeremiah, so confused. What's Kinko's? Yeah. It was a place back in the day where they had copy machines and we would pay lots of money to go and make copies. I know that's bizarre. Yeah, it's going, yeah. Yeah, paper is, no, just kidding. And so he would copy that. Now that's a manuscript. Now, let's say Jeremiah hands it off to somebody else, right? He hands it off to Moses. Moses wants a copy. He makes a copy of that, right? Now it's another manuscript. And so what happens is, as those are copied, now we have lots and lots and lots of manuscripts. What you want, this is true for any work from antiquity, what you want is you want lots of manuscripts, and you want them as early as you can get them to the original, because there's less time for error to creep in. So you want lots of manuscripts, because then we can compare all the manuscripts, and you want them early. Now, the reality is, the New Testament is the best authenticated work of antiquity that there is. In fact, if the evidence is so overwhelming, if it wasn't the New Testament, everyone would recognize that we have what they wrote. The problem is, obviously, the New Testament makes claims on your life, and people don't necessarily like that, right? The New Testament is better authenticated than the next 10 pieces of classical literature combined. So that's what I want to show you here. I mean, this stuff is super interesting when you start looking into it. So you got people like Sir Frederick Kenyon, the former director of the British Museum. He says it cannot be too strongly asserted that in substance, the text of the Bible is certain, his language, especially the case with the New Testament. So again, we talk about, how do we know we have an accurate copy? With the New Testament, we have earlier copies than any other work from antiquity. We have more copies than any other work for antiquity. We have better accurately copied manuscripts than any other work from antiquity. And we have more abundantly supported manuscripts than any other work from antiquity. In fact, the evidence, it's like almost like we're piling on. Like we have so much evidence in our favor. Okay, so here's a chart talking about how early we have manuscripts from the New Testament and other works from antiquity, okay? So the blue bar there is the years between dates written in the earliest fragment that we have. The orange bar is the years between the date written in the earliest manuscript we have. So many of the manuscripts we have, we've lost most of the manuscripts. We have fragments for it. So the John Ryland's papyri is one of the earliest manuscripts, fragments that we have. It's just a fragment of the Gospel of John that we can date to, I think, it's like 125 AD. But we have like the Codex Sinaiticus and others that it's like 325, which is a full Bible, a full New Testament, okay? So now, but look at the difference between the New Testament and every other work from antiquity. So the New Testament, right, in the Greek, about 225 years to the full, again, the Codex Sinaiticus. But look at that, you know, about 25 years for just the fragments. And then, in all the languages, you know, about the same. Now, compare that to some of these others. Homer's Iliad, about 1,500 years from the autograph to the earliest manuscript that we have. Now, nobody's saying that there weren't tons of other manuscripts in the meantime. Like, we're not saying that. What we're saying is that these are the earliest that we have. And again, with any of these works from antiquity, we're trying to recreate the original because we want to make sure, okay, do we have what the authors wrote? Now we can begin to examine that document. And so look, 1,500 years and, 283 years for the fragments, right? That's, so again, the earliest fragment in manuscripts from any other work from antiquity. But you also want lots of manuscripts. So in the New Testament Greek language, we have about 6,000 Greek manuscripts. Now again, some fragments and some full manuscripts, about 6,000. When you add all the languages together and the other languages, close to 24,000 manuscripts. I mean, compare that with Pliny the Younger, his natural history of 7 manuscripts. Again, no one's saying there weren't other manuscripts, tons more, but we're just saying this is what we have to work with. Tacitus's Annals, 36 manuscripts. Sophocles, 3 manuscripts. Homer's Iliad is the best attested from, second to the New Testament, and it's about 1,900 manuscripts. So what we can do, so again, we have these about 6,000 handwritten Greek manuscripts, right, which is just amazing amount, over 18,000 manuscripts in other languages. Again, earlier manuscripts than any other work from antiquity. There are some disputed manuscripts that are in the first century. In fact, a couple years ago, They thought they discovered a manuscript from the Gospel of Mark that they thought was in the first century. They've since pulled back on that to think that maybe it wasn't an original. So, but we're discovering more and more manuscripts all the time. So, you know, it could be the case that there are manuscripts out there that'll take us all the way to the first century, which is, you know, amazing. Again, most of the New Testament, including all the Gospels, survived from about AD 250. There's lots of these complete manuscripts that are out there that with textual indicators that take us all the way back to early 2nd century. What's interesting is, even if you didn't, and we'll talk to you about how we can recreate the original here in a second. So we've got tons of manuscripts and we've got them early. But even if we didn't have that, this is amazing. Diocletian was a Roman emperor in the late 3rd century, not a fan of Christianity, to say the least, right? He wanted Christians killed. He ordered all Bibles to be taken up and to be burned. And I think if you had a Bible, that you could get the death sentence if you had a Bible. Now, what's interesting is after he died, everyone came out and they had held their Bibles. They had held on to their Bibles, right? Because they said, you know, we don't care what some man says, right? We care about the Word of God. But here's what's cool. Even if Diocletian had been successful, even if all of the Bibles were taken out, if all the manuscripts were taken out and burned, we could still recreate the entire New Testament just from the quotations from the early church fathers. The New Testament is quoted so many times by the early church fathers, but all but 11 verses of the New Testament could be recreated just from their quotations. Now, what does that do? It gives us another line of evidence, another piece of evidence that we can now use to try to... Now, all those manuscripts, all those quotations from the early church fathers, we can take all that together and we can recreate the original. So this is the science of textual criticism. This is not like the telephone game. It's not the idea that I whisper something to David and it passes all around and, oh, we just... all these plain and precious truths were taken out. No, this is how it's done. We take all the manuscript evidence. So let's say here's an original. Okay, and then let's say we've got 4 copies here. Okay, now we don't have the original. Let's say we don't have the original. And we have copy 1, copy 2, copy 3, and copy 4, right, that say this, maybe. Oh, there we go. That say, in each of these copies, this is what we have. God is, and let's say there's a smudge there, or there's 2 letters there or something, and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. The second copy says the spacing is messed up, and there's a word smudge there. Copy 3, you see the same thing. Does anybody doubt what the original said? Anybody? What does it say? What did the original say? God is just, and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. So what we do is we take all the manuscripts and we compare them to each other, and in doing that, we can recreate the original with certainty, especially if we have lots and lots and lots of manuscripts, which we do. And the fact is, this is actually more errors than there would be even in the manuscript evidence that we have now. So, I mean, this is just another example, sort of taking the same thing, but it's just saying what we can do, if we don't have the original, we don't have, you know, you have these families of texts, we don't have the originals, we don't have the copies, and we have these errors in them, but we compare all of these together, and we can recreate the original, again, with certainty. Now, why, again, this is sort of this is speculation, but I think it's a good argument. Why could this be better than having the original? So you could say, look, wouldn't it be just better if God just preserved the original? Has anybody been to Israel? Been to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? Well, number one, if you haven't been to Israel, come on one of our trips. Number two, if you have been to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, what do people do there? Have you ever been like right to the little, it's like that little... concrete, I don't know, it's like what's right there where they think the crucifixion was, right? People are lying, yeah, they're lying down, they're worshiping it. So I think number one, if we had the original, we probably, because that's what we're prone to do, we probably venerate it and worship it. But number two, if someone had the original, theoretically, what could they do with it? They could change it. Historically, have there been some bad people that would have had access to those documents for a period of time? You betcha. And they could have changed it. In fact, maybe they didn't like the way that certain things said, so they could have changed it to fit their pet theological positions. Instead, so if we had the original, they could do that. So instead, we don't have the originals, but we have so many copies and copies of copies of copies of copies that we can recreate the original with certainty, and it actually protects the original, which is amazing. So some people will say, people like Bart Ehrman, for one. So Bart Ehrman was a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where we used to live in Wilmington, North Carolina, just down the road. And he was a professing Christian, went to Moody Bible Institute. He studied under Bruce Metzger, who is one of the best textual critics ever, and actually dedicated his first book, was it Jesus Interrupted, or what? He dedicated it to Bruce Metzger, which is interesting. But he makes a big deal about, in all these manuscripts, the number of errors that are in the manuscript evidence of the Bible. So he'll say things like, there are over 200,000 errors in the manuscripts, which is actually more words than there are in the Bible. And that's supposed to scare you and freak you out. The problem is, all the textual critics, they say, we know this. Like, you're not saying anything in your popular level books that we haven't been talking about in the academia for years. We know all this. These are not errors, most of them, but they're actually variants, right? So in the overwhelming vast majority of these variants are spelling errors, grammatical errors, things that literally make no, you know, like we talked about in that one example, maybe the spacing was off or something like that. And they're spread throughout the, you know, almost 6,000 manuscripts. So let's say you had one error, and it was copied in like 600 different manuscripts. Now somehow you've got 600 different errors. But again, we showed you just a minute ago, we can still, with that error, we can still know with certainty, and we showed you just a minute ago, what that original said. So we can do the same thing with this manuscript evidence. So Westcott and Hort, who were the guys that put together the NIV, this is back in the 1800s, at that time, they said there was only one in 60 variants had any significance. If that was true, that would make a text that was 98.3% pure. But since then, we've got a lot more textual evidence. We've got a lot more manuscript evidence. So Bruce Metzger, again, Bart Ehrman's mentor, he says the text we have is 99.5% accurate. But the thing is, the 0.5% in question, not only does it not affect a single doctrine of the Christian faith, but no one is hiding that from you. So, like, for right now, all of you, if you open your Bible, the Pew Bible, and you turn to John 7:53 and 8 through 8:11. Jeremiah, you turn to that and see. We'll play Bible. Who can do it fastest, right? It's like the sword drill, you know, when you're a kid. All right, you got it? John 7:53. What does it say in your Bible right before John 7:53? Or either that or in a footnote below it? No, like is there a footnote? Is there a asterisk? Is there a, and what does it say?
It says John 8:42. That's a
cross. Yeah.
Oh, a cross. Footnote? Oh, my Bible's bigger.
That's not bigger. Okay. What about yours, Moses?
I don't have footnotes in mine.
Okay, this is going terribly, people. And I was going to say, yeah. All right, hold on.
John 7:53 through 8:11 is not found in most people's manuscripts.
Right, okay. So most Bibles, right, will tell you that the woman caught in adultery, the earliest manuscripts that we have do not include that story in it. Now, okay, does that mean, what does that mean? We want to be careful with that, right? That means, number one, I don't want to build theology on something that happened just there because it potentially could have been a later edition. Now, it could be the case that we find earlier manuscripts and actually find those earlier manuscripts and it proves that it was in there. The same with the long ending of Mark. Mark 16 through 9 through 20 is not in the earliest manuscripts that we have. What's interesting, I come from Southwest Virginia, and in the Appalachian Mountains, there are pastors that have built entire theology on the long ending of Mark, and they handle snakes, poisonous snakes, because they think that that's what it's saying. Now, we would just say, be careful. Yeah, don't do that, right? Don't build your theology on something that's just in there. If you see it in other places that we do know was in the original, right, then that's where we want to build our theology. But the thing is, no one's hiding this. And so, but you, again, you take the long ending of Mark out, you take the woman caught in adultery, you take some of these other, again, there's not many, but you take some of these other potentially disputed passages, you take them out, you haven't lost any doctrine. You've lost no doctrine. So we can still be certain doctrinally that we have what the authors wrote. And so that takes us, so again, if that's true, which hopefully, you know, we can talk about more if you want, now we know that we have what they wrote, then obviously the next question is what they wrote true, right? And that's what he's going to talk about in the next segment. But let's think about this again. So going back to the original, our LDS friends come to you, they tell you the eighth article of faith, that we believe the Bible as far as it's been translated correctly, that plain and precious truths have been taken out of the Bible, that we can't trust that we have what they wrote, and that we'll use the telephone game as an example. We could say, well, I'll actually agree with you that it's like the telephone game, but let me tell you how it actually was. Okay? And so we say, here's the same example. Remember, before the telephone game, David started and he whispered something to Jeremiah in his ear, and then he whispered, and by the time it all got to Pastor Bob, it was completely different, right? And they said, that's like the Bible. No, it'd be like this. He writes it down. He then shows it to Jeremiah, who writes it down. Now we lose this. Then as we pass it, as we go from person to person, every person writes it down. And we go all the way to Pastor Bob, who writes it down. Now we take all of those written accounts, we pull them all together, we know chronologically when they were, and we can find where the errors crept in. We can find where they crept in, and we can recreate the original with certainty. That is more like the textual, that's more like the way in which the documents really were transmitted. And again, we have these written records that we can go back on, and we can confirm that yes, we have what the authors wrote. So I think that is super, you know, A, it's super helpful and super interesting. And if it's the case, right, then that takes us to this next question, which David will now take, which is what they wrote true?
So because we're doing four sessions tonight instead of just three, we're actually doing four in the same amount of time. So no bathroom break. Okay. Even though I could actually use a bathroom break. Okay. You guys didn't need to know that. Shut up, David. Don't talk about that. Okay. All right. So I think this is minimal facts argument for evidence for the resurrection. A professor named Gary Habermas, you may have heard of him. He's written extensively on this subject. He actually came up with the minimal facts argument for the resurrection. And what's so unique about this argument is that should we do the video? Yeah, we can do the video.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. What's so unique about this argument is that the most critical of scholars, like Bart Ehrman, who is agnostic, you know, leaning towards atheism, agree with all of the facts we're going to present. Okay? So we'll get to those in just a second, but first, our favorite.
But hold on. And yeah. Some of you have never been to Jerusalem? Right. If you haven't, you can go to the Holy Land Experience in Orlando, Florida, and it's basically the same thing. So this video was taken. Bill Maher, who is this documentary is called Religious. It's like a combination of religion and ridiculous because he's an atheist. But he goes to the Holy Land Experience, and this is the guy who portrays Jesus, and like they crucify him at like 3 and 6 every day, and it's like, you know, it's a moneymaker or whatever. But anyway, if you can't get all the way to Jerusalem, go to Orlando, check out Disney World, and then you can, you know, check out the Holy Land at the same time.
Does it ever bother you that the story
can
of a man mm-hmm. who was born of a virgin, was resurrected, your bio mm-hmm. was something that was going around the Mediterranean for at least 1,000 years? We've got Krishna, who was in India 1,000 years before Christ. Krishna was a carpenter, born of a virgin, baptized in a river.
Are you saying that was written in history? That was written down in history, is what you're saying?
Absolutely. There's the Persian god Mithras 600 years before Christ, born December 25th, performed miracles, resurrected on the third day, known as the Lamb, the Way, the Truth, the Light, the Savior, Messiah.
Stop! Blasphemer!
All I know is that I don't go by that, hearsay, that. So I go by the Word of God. I know that's what I believe.
Well, I believe it.
Believe
because
it,
it's
yes.
True. Okay, it's not that. It's
but
not
there's
just,
a difference between truth and what you believe.
But in the Bible tells us that all things are possible with God. Okay.
Study the religions of the Mediterranean region for 1,000 years before. Many of the gods were born on December 25th. It's
no,
not a new
it's,
one.
It's not. It's but it's not.
It's funny you should bring that up because, of course, in Star Wars Episode 1, Phantom Menace, Anakin is born to a virgin, and
really?
People see that and they say, "Wait a second, where have we heard that before?"
Right.
It's not original.
But
when
the Jesus story
happened,
wasn't original.
How so?
All the old paintings on the tomb. like an Egyptian. Walk like an Egyptian.
Let me ask you a question. Let's say, if you take the side that this is all made up.
I do.
What if you're wrong?
What if you're wrong?
Okay. I can't help but love Bill Maher. I'm sorry, because he's like so many of my relatives. I mean, it's just like, I believe everything he says is wrong, but I just still love him. So anyway, so let's do 2 minutes. You're having a conversation. Now you're in the position where you're playing Jesus and he's crucified twice a day, right? And you're having this conversation. But obviously this guy who, you know, he didn't read the book Tactics, did he, right? Like, so you guys have some tactics now under your belt. Spend 2 minutes. What are some questions that you would ask Bill Maher? Okay. I don't know if that was 2 minutes, but I'm going to call it 2 minutes. So I want you to think about that. And then a few slides from now, we're going to get to some questions about whether or not what Bill Maher was representing in this film are actually accurate. Okay.
Newsflash, they're not.
If we tell you guys, don't trust what we say, you got to check it out for yourselves. Don't trust what Bill Maher says either. Okay. All right. So Richard Lewontin, 1997, he makes this statement. He says, it's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes. That means that molecules cause everything, okay? To create an apparatus of investigation, a set of concepts that produce material explanations, okay? No matter how counterintuitive that material explanation might be, okay? No matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So he's saying, no matter how dumb it may seem that we are calling supernatural events natural, and no matter that we actually don't have a materialistic way to explain them in any way, shape, or form, we cannot allow there to be a supernatural explanation, or in his words, to allow a divine foot in the door. Which
just means he's not going to allow miracles as an explanation, right? Talking to an atheist student who's been coming to our meetings, and he just will not. He says miracles are always the least likely explanation ever, and I will never admit to it. So I was kind of like, so that means if a miracle happened right in front of your face, you wouldn't believe it. And he was kind of like, yeah, you're probably right. I wouldn't believe it. So like, all right, then he's telling me that he's probably not interested in that evidence, right? And so, but we've talked a little bit more to try to help him to see that seems irrational. But this is the kind of view that many people have. That's why we would say we first start with, does God exist? If God exists, miracles are possible. And obviously, you know, this is the most important miracle that proves the reliability of the New Testament.
Yeah, and that is a good point. It makes me think of Gary Habermas's testimony of how he came to faith. He was an atheist, And he remembers looking out into his backyard and praying, okay, God, if you're real, if you really exist, knock that tree down. And he literally went away. He like took a nap or something and came back, and the tree had fallen down in his backyard. He was like, nah, still don't believe it. So, again, he's not allowing a divine foot in the door. But this mentality will explain how these critical scholars that we're about to look at, who understand and accept these four minimal facts that I'm going to give you, will look at all of this evidence and say God still doesn't exist. Still don't believe in a supernatural explanation for the resurrection. So, the most critical of scholars agree with all of these minimal facts regarding the life, death, resurrection of Yeshua of Nazareth and the reaction of his followers. I realize that I use Yeshua instead of Jesus. This is a Hebrew term for his name. It means salvation, okay? So, just in case you've never heard that before. If walking around the street when people were, you know, around Jesus and his brothers were tall and his mother was calling him, they weren't saying, hey, Jesus. They were saying, hey, Yeshua, okay? Actually, they didn't say hey either, but okay. Okay. What we conclude from these minimal facts is up to us, right? So we're going to look, we're all looking at the same minimal facts here. The atheist, the skeptic, the cynic, the believer, we're all looking at these same minimal facts, and then what we do with those is up to us. So, but what if the Bible is not reliable? So Aaron just gave all this evidence for the Bible being reliable. Like what this is what they had, what they wrote, right? So for the Christian who believes the Bible is reliable and inspired, right? Yeshua is raised from the dead. Why? Because we trust the word of God as being accurate and true. Okay, for what about the skeptic who believes the Bible is reliable, like it's an important work of history, it's reliable, but it's not inspired. What about that? Yeshua is still raised from the dead based upon this minimal fact argument. What about the skeptic or even the cynic who believes that the Bible is not reliable, we can't trust it, and it's just a book of ancient literature, obviously not inspired? Guess what? Yeshua is still raised from the dead. Okay, so this is what the minimal facts argument does. So it doesn't matter what you believe about this. Obviously, the first session we did was your beliefs don't determine whether something is true or false, right? Yesterday. So it doesn't matter what you believe, because the reality is that the minimal facts, which everyone accepts, Yeshua is raised from the dead. So what are these minimal facts? Yeshua died by crucifixion, that's number one. There was an empty tomb, that's number two. Yeshua's followers believed they had seen him alive and died for that belief. Okay, very important. And the changed lives of Saul, it's Paul. You know, I meant to go and I fixed these typos in this one, but I didn't, so there you go. Yaakov or Jacob, I just combined them too. Jacob, okay. And Yeshua's brothers, okay? So changed lives of Saul, Jacob, that's James, by the way, the author of James. He's Yeshua's half-brother and Yeshua's brothers. Okay, these are the minimal facts. Minimal fact number one, Yeshua died by crucifixion. So Flavius Josephus, Tacitus, Lucian, Babylonian Talmud, and six additional critically accepted ancient sources testify to Yeshua dying by crucifixion. Josephus in 37 CE to 100 CE, that's AD, he states that Yeshua was crucified during the reign of Tiberius by the prefect Pontius Pilate. Okay, this is in Antiquities 18:63. He also records that Yaakov, or James, brother of Yeshua, called the Messiah, being brought before the Sanhedrin for stoning. So very important when we start looking at the changed lives of James, Jacob, and Paul is that Josephus records him dying for the belief that Yeshua was the Messiah. Okay, Cornelius Tacitus, 55 to 120 CE, he says, therefore, to stop the rumor, Nero substituted as culprits and punished in the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Christus, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate, and the pernicious superstition, what might that have been, was checked for a moment only to break out once more, not merely in Judea, the home of the disease, but in the capital itself where all things horrible or shameful in the world collect and find a vogue. So here's another witness from the time. So again, these are extra biblical witnesses. So again, we're not talking about what's written here, even though skeptical scholars still do trust certain accounts in the Gospels as being fact. Tacitus. Christians are named after the founder of Christus. This is the summary here. This Christus died by state death penalty during the Emperor Tiberius' reign 14 to 37, I live 10 minutes from the city of Tiberia, named after Emperor Tiberius. Under the direction of Pontius Pilate, his death did not put an end to the pernicious superstition, and his followers and superstition spread to Rome. So here is a epigraph we found, not that I found it, but found in the mid-1960s in Caesarea Maritima on the coast of Israel, and it reads, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. So not only do we have written evidence from these guys in manuscripts, but we also have epigraphical evidence that we find in the land of Israel of Pilate's existence. And until this stone was found, many people suggested that what the other historians wrote was not to be trusted because we couldn't prove it. And then we have multiple ways of verifying that this person, Pontius Pilate, was a real character in history. Lucian, second century Greek satirist, he says, the Christians, and again, this is an enemy of who the Christian people were. This is important. When we get to enemy attestation, I want you to remember this. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and who was crucified on that account. You see these misguided creatures start with the general condition, that they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt of death and voluntary self-devotion, which are so common among them. And then it was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment they are converted and deny gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. Babylonian Talmud, Yeshu, which is a Hebrew term that means may his name, it's actually an acronym that says may his name be blotted out forever, was hanged on Passover Eve. 40 days previous, the herald cried, he is being led out for stoning because he has practiced sorcery and led Israel astray and enticed them into apostasy. Whoever has anything to say in his defense, let him come and declare it. As nothing was brought forward in his defense, he was hanged on Passover Eve. So here is an account in the Babylonian Talmud, which we would disagree with the details of, but here we have enemies of the alleged Jewish Messiah, Yeshua, attesting to him being hanged, which in this context was crucifixion. So we have early attestation. Bart Ehrman, again, we've talked about him, professor at UNC, New Testament professor at UNC. He said in his book, Did Jesus Exist? He lists 11 independent ancient sources for the crucifixion of Jesus. And it's really interesting because Paul Myers, a professor of history at Western Michigan, states that most of the events in the ancient world depend on one witness. So the chart that Aaron showed earlier with all of the manuscripts of different people who lived and wrote on all of these things, the events in those manuscripts, so someone like Alexander the Great, which I may have a slide in here, I can't remember, most of the people in history are one witness. There's one manuscript story slash witness to them existing. And he says that two witnesses make an event unimpeachable. So Ehrman gives 11 independent historical sources for which scholars in his community would say you only need two to make the event of the crucifixion unimpeachable. Does that make sense? So guess what? It means it happened, all right? Other ancient events. What evidence is there for other historical events? So if we're going to throw out the crucifixion as something that didn't happen just because men wrote about it and we don't believe them because it had to do with a miracle, even though we have enemy attestations stating that it happened, the earliest reference to Alexander the Great is 300 years after his death. And the best sources, that means like just the earliest reference, but that specific reference isn't the best source for that, okay? The best sources are 425 to 450 years after his death by Plutarch and Arrian. And this is a figure of history who no one disputes. So the internet myth, and that's all it is the internet myth, that Yeshua didn't even exist is complete rubbish, okay? Complete nonsense. Tiberius Caesar, everyone knows about Tiberius Caesar. Again, Tiberia, the city I live pretty near in Israel, is named after him. And best account of him, his existence is by Tacitus, 80 years after his death, and that reference is from 110 AD. The best reference is 180 years after his death by Dio Cassius. But no one refutes that Tiberius Caesar existed or that the events that he didn't happen. Early eyewitness testimony. Bart Ehrman, again, agnostic, leaning towards atheism, states that the creed found in 1 Corinthians 15:3 dates to 1 to 2 years after the crucifixion. Okay? So this early creed that basically runs the litany of who Yeshua was, that he died by crucifixion, that he was raised from the dead, and then James Dunn puts it to within 6 months of the crucifixion. The gospel and epistles were all written in the first century with oral transmission by eyewitnesses extending into the second century. So what's so important about that? It's not just that we have this stuff written down. It's that if you're in the first century and you hear this alleged thing that's happened, what can you go do? You can go and ask the people that saw it happen, right? And then the people that saw it happen tell other people about it. And of course, you get this explosion of belief that's going on in the Near Eastern world. But then Tacitus picks up on that and Josephus picks up on that. And they start recording the events of these people who are then changing their lives and dying for what they believed in because Yeshua was crucified and allegedly this pernicious superstition that he was raised from the dead. The crucifixion is arguably the most well-documented event in ancient human history. There's more about it than anything else.
Because there's also a good one of the arguments that when we talk about the reliability of the New Testament, it would be these things that are in the scriptures that can confirm facts that happened, but they wouldn't have been intended to be there. And there's a great example for the crucifixion. In John 19, it says, when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and once there came out blood and water. So when on the cross, the reason that you would die would be asphyxiation, right? Because you're pushing yourself up, and eventually you can't do that, so you would die by asphyxiation. And so you can look this up in the Journal of the American Medical Association, it was like 40 years ago, they had all these medical doctors just look, can we determine if Jesus was crucified? And they looked at this line, and they said, that wasn't water, that was pericardial fluid. So what happens is, when you die of asphyxiation, pericardial fluid will build up in your lungs and your heart, and it's a clear liquid. And so when they stabbed him in the side, and it said water came out, and this clear liquid, they didn't know what that clear liquid was, so they said water. But the doctors all knew that was pericardial fluid, which means he had died by asphyxiation. So this would be another good reason to believe that he had died by crucifixion, that he was dead before they even stabbed him in the side. Obviously, stabbing in the side is even better evidence that he died by crucifixion than he was dead on the cross.
And there's like a whole array of things regarding the crucifixion and details within the Gospels, which is really important to know and interesting to study as well. But again, minimal fact, Yeshua died by crucifixion. No one who's a critical scholar disagrees with that fact, okay? What's the second fact? Empty tomb. It's critically accepted that the tomb was empty, okay? So all of these critical scholars, Bart Ehrman, agnostic, leading towards atheism, doesn't believe, okay? But he says the tomb was empty. Jesus died by crucifixion, he says, along with all these other people, and the tomb was empty. What are the explanations for the empty tomb, right? Number one, the disciples stole the body. This is the original explanation, right? The disciples stole the body, okay? People went to the wrong tomb. So these two are, even though these are these are number one and number two, like these are the most popular explanations here, I think are, if you think about it for 2 seconds, they're the dumbest things you could. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just, you know, you're really grasping at straws here. Particularly when you get to the disciples, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but that's fine. They're being tortured and killed for their faith. Okay? If this was all a hoax and you're all about to die by terrible torture, what's the one thing you can go do? Just go get the body and parade it around, right? But it's also an admission by the Pharisees and the Sadducees that there was an empty tomb, right? Because they're giving the explanation that the disciples stole the body. The other thing is that people went to the wrong tomb and actually did an experiment with a couple of pastor buddies of ours came to Israel this past year. And I took them from the house of Caiaphas, which is the chief priest's house of the day, which we can go today and see. There's actually a dungeon there where they held prisoners and tortured them, and there's a deep pit where we think that Yeshua was actually kept during just before his trial, his Jewish trial. You can walk from where he was tried under Jewish law. It was a fake trial, right? It was made up. But where he was tried, you can actually walk from the Garden of Gethsemane to the place he was tried, to the Antonia Fortress, and then to either one of the proposed tomb sites today, including the crucifixion sites along the way, which there are two of them today. There could be more than that, which is the two main ones today. You can do all of that in an hour. And so from the middle of the old city of Jerusalem, you can go to either tomb in less than 10 minutes if you walk briskly. So if this massive event happened, remember when Yeshua is on the road to Emmaus, right? And he comes across two disciples and he says, hey, what's going on? They're like, where have you been? You know what I mean? And then he explains through the Old Testament, he proves him to the Messiah. And then he reveals himself, right? But they're like, where have you been? Are you the only person in Jerusalem that doesn't know what has happened? So guess what? Everyone knew what had happened. Everyone knew that allegedly Yeshua had raised from the dead. And if you really wanted to, what can you go do? You just go check the tomb. You're no more than a 10-minute walk from the center of this old city of Jerusalem to check out for yourself whether the tomb was empty or not. So there's no way that a person, a resident of Jerusalem, even a non-resident, because you have family there most likely because you're there for the Passover, went to the wrong tomb. I think it's impossible. Yeshua was never buried, acknowledges his death, and now has to deal with the resurrection. So even if he was never buried, what is that acknowledging? That there was still an empty tomb. I think this is kind of a weak argument in general, but it's still one that they make. Swoon theory. So Islamists make this claim that Yeshua actually never died. There's some other people that make this claim too, saying that he was just up there on the cross after he had been beaten by Romans, up to 40 lashes, severe blood loss. He's been up all night before that. And then professional killers don't know how to kill him at that point. They don't know how to finish him off. So I think this is extremely weak. This is all that these soldiers' job was to do, was crucify people and make sure that they died. All right. Now, we only have in history one example of someone who survived crucifixion, only one. And he was actually taken down with two other people, and those two other people actually died even though they were taken off the cross. Okay. This happened in the Middle Ages. And then again, it's merely a copycat legend of Mithras and Osiris. So getting back to our friend Bill Maher and his claims about, we'll just do one example here because they all pretty much follow the same thing. Mithras here. Number one, it's too late to influence Christianity. So even though it's claiming to have happened before the birth and life of Yeshua, the evidence for that is the second century AD. Okay, and so he's born out of a rock, not a virgin. Big difference there. He was said to be a god, not a teacher. He didn't have 12 disciples. He didn't sacrifice himself. He sacrificed a bull. We don't know anything about his death. And there was certainly no resurrection. And guess what? Just because we celebrate Christmas on December 25th, very few people actually think that Yeshua's birthday was on December 25th. So that's just, that whole thing is just kind of ridiculous. You have anything to say on that one, Aaron?
Well, we would say even if, we would say that yes, a lot of these alleged rising and dying saviors, they happened before, but they were written after. That's what we're saying. So if anybody's copying, it could have been them copying from Christianity. But we could say, look, even if it was the case that there were these other alleged rising and dying saviors that happened before Christianity or before Jesus, that in and of itself doesn't make the claims of Christianity true or false. Because we have to evaluate the evidence that we're presenting. So David's giving you the evidence for the resurrection here. And there's an example that one of our a colleague or someone who's an expert on the resurrection uses, and he says, for example, if I told you about, so everyone think about what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a allegedly unsinkable ship that was over 100 years ago, starts with the letter T, it sailed in the North Atlantic, hit some icebergs, broke in half, there weren't enough life jackets or life boats on board, and over, 3,000, a couple thousand people died. I'd obviously be talking about what? No, I would be talking about this book called The Titan, that was called The Unsinkable Titan, that was written about 50 years before the Titanic. And literally, if you look at it, the characteristics match up amazingly. So 200 years from now, people are going to think, oh, obviously the Titanic was made up, right? Because somehow this person had to write something that's somewhat similar. No, we look at the evidence for the Titanic. We know that that happened. It just happened to be that this fictional account sort of matched up to that. So in a similar way, even if these alleged accounts were written earlier, and even if there were these similarities, they're not. If you actually look into it, the similarities don't exist. It still wouldn't mean that the Christian accounts are false, because you have to look at the evidence for the biblical Christian accounts. And here we're looking at the evidence for the resurrection, and what we're showing you is the evidence shows that, you know, he was crucified, that the tomb was empty, that the disciples believed it, and the changed life of James and Paul. So all of those still have to be accounted for, even if that this was written before, which it wasn't.
Yeah, I love that parallel. That's really interesting. It makes me want to go read that book. Fact number three, followers believed they had seen the risen Yeshua, okay? Yeshua's followers believed they had seen him alive. So Peter, Jacob, Paul, they're all martyrs at some point, right? And they died for something they knew to be true or false, right? So all three were killed for holding fast to Yeshua being raised from the dead. All three knew for certain whether or not Yeshua was really raised from the dead. People always say, well, what about, look, Islamic martyrs are dying for something they believe to be true. That's not what we're talking about. These men died for something they knew to either be true or false. This is not something they heard from someone else and it was a great sales pitch and they were promised, you know, 40 virgins or whatever it is after they died, right? This is something they absolutely knew was either true or false. So what do skeptical scholars say about that? Dale Allison, Princeton Theological Seminary, says, I'm a skeptic, but I'm sure the risen Jesus appeared to his disciples after his death. So again, critical scholars accept this. They accept that Yeshua's followers believed they had seen the risen Lord. E.P. Sanders, Duke University historian, says, the following is a historical fact. The earliest disciples saw the risen Jesus. I don't know how they saw him, but they saw the risen Jesus. So again, this is what I'm talking about. We're looking at all the same facts, and then as human beings with reasoning minds and wills to either accept or reject the revelation that God is giving us, do different things with these facts, right? We come to different conclusions. Fact number four, the changed lives of Saul and Jacob, Paul and James. Jacob, Yeshua's half-brother, did not follow him during his ministry and even taunted him. Mark 3 and 6 and John 7. Jacob and brothers were with Yeshua in the upper room after the resurrection, Acts 1:14. Jacob becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church, and Paul reports his activities to him as the leader, as James, Jacob, the leader of the Jerusalem church. And then again, when we look at early attestation, Josephus confirms that Jacob died a martyr's death. So here we have one of Yeshua's brothers, and then we know the rest of his brothers, but Jacob is more prominent because he becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church. Doesn't believe, you know, imagine growing up with Yeshua when you're a kid and like, oh, he's a perfect child and, you know, oh, he never does anything wrong. Oh, he's, you know, it's like the Joseph complex a little bit, right? Except he actually was way better than Joseph. He was perfect. And then all of a sudden, these, oh my good, like he's being killed. Your mother's distraught. This is terrible, all right? He was my brother after all. We don't really know where he came from. Where was dad in that whole thing? I don't know. But, and then all of a sudden, they're dying for something they believe to be ridiculous, okay? And then they're becoming the leader and leaders within the church. Saul, of course, we know his story, right? He has a 180 transformation. He goes from maybe the one of the most prominent persecutors of the early following of Yeshua to the most prolific writer of the New Testament. And he dies a martyr's death in Rome historically by beheading. How can you account for this? How can you account for these realities? So, what can account for these men and others who died for what they knew to be true or false, right? Is it money? Did they get money for these things? No. Did they gain sex? No. Did they gain any power? No, they all died. They didn't gain any power. So these are the motivations for mankind, money, sex, and power. That's what motivates us as human beings. We certainly know that's what motivated Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. We know that's what motivated Muhammad. We know that's what's motivated papal authority over the millennia. So what explains this radical behavior? Because they didn't get any of these things. There were no benefits for them other than they were simply dying for something that they thought, but no, knew to be either true or false. So what is the leading skeptical views? Number one is drug-induced hallucinations. They were just drug addicts. They were on shrooms. And they hallucinated these things, right? This is, again, going back to the video yesterday with Richard Dawkins telling the man who was very sincere that he was just hallucinating, right? Maybe these were grief-induced hallucinations. Maybe these were grief-induced dreams. Again, they're not denying that they had seen the risen Lord. They're not denying that. And they're not denying that they had these radical transformation of the lives of Paul and James and his brothers. They're not denying any of that. They're trying now, we have to come up with an explanation because we know this was the truth. I never wake up, like last night, you know, this morning I woke up and I turned to Aaron and I said, what about that dream we had last night? Right? Does that ever happen? We just wake up and we all had the same dream because we were really sad about something? No, that doesn't happen. And it also doesn't happen that when we all trip out on shrooms, right, which we're not going to, obviously that's not happening, but people also don't have group hallucinations. That also does not happen. And certainly not to the point that would convince later generation who weren't firsthand viewers of what actually happened. Maybe they're 10 years down the road, and now they're going to Uncle Shmuley, who saw Yeshua rise from the dead, and asking him about it. And he's like, well, let me tell you about this crazy hallucination that we all had that it testified to this event. No, I mean, you do not have a movement which lasts literally until today that gets off under the most harsh of what's the word? I don't know. Persecutions, that's the word. Thank you. Without it being true. This was not just drug-induced hallucinations, grief-induced dreams, grief-induced hallucinations, but these are the kinds of answers they've come up with. So when we look at this, what are the six? Go ahead.
I think the other great thing about the minimal facts argument is to say that it was a hallucination, it doesn't account for the empty tomb. It doesn't account for the changed life of James, and it doesn't account for the changed life of Paul, because they weren't, you know, they didn't want it to be true. They said it was because of, James and Paul said it was because of the resurrection, right, that they changed their views. And so the great thing about the minimal facts is whatever explanation you want to offer has to account for all the data. That we think it's a bad explanation no matter what, but even if you want to say just for the sake of this, I'll grant it still doesn't account for all the data, because it doesn't account for the empty tomb, it doesn't account for the changed life of James, and it doesn't account for the changed life of Paul. That's why we think this is such a good argument.
Yeah, and also, you know, Habermas, these are just four. He gives up to 12 that all skeptical, critical scholars agree to. So what do we have? We have enemy attestation, Jewish leadership, claim of stolen body. So the enemies are attesting that there was an empty tomb, right? Enemies of the movement of Christus are attesting to the belief in this crucifixion, in this Lord, in this pernicious superstition, right? Embarrassing testimony. What were the men doing when the women go to the tomb and discover that it's empty? They were hiding in fear for the Jewish leadership. Why? Because they think they're next. So if you're making up a story about this movement that you want to get started, what are you going to do? Are you going to make up a story where the women are actually the heroes of the story in this day and age? That's not going to happen. I don't even think that would happen now, right? No, they're hiding in fear. And if you're making this up, you make yourself the hero. And you certainly don't make it about women whose testimony was certainly not taken to the same level that a man's testimony was, certainly not in a court of law or even public opinion. We have early testimonies, the gospel, the creeds that we talked about in 1 Corinthians, contemporary with the event. Eyewitness testimony, collaborative testimony, not contradictory testimony. What does this mean? It means that if we all witness a bank robbery, what critics of the Bible want to tell you is that these are contradictory eyewitness testimonies of the resurrection, okay, of the events surrounding the resurrection or even the crucifixion itself, okay? But that's actually not what we see. If we all see a bank robbery, we're all in the bank, we see somebody come in, they hold up the joint, we're on the floor, you know, some of you over there, some of you over here, I'm on the floor over here. And then after it happens, thank God we all survive, and the cops come and interview all of us, right? We're going to give accounts of what we saw. So what we don't want to happen is, what the cops specifically don't want to happen, and actually there's an apologist who's a believer now, named James Warner Wallace. He's a cold case homicide detective. He said the last thing you want is for people to get together after an event and then talk about what they saw. Because then all of their stories are going to start lining. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that detail. Oh, really? I didn't see that happen. But now I'll just add it to the collective memory of this event. So we don't want the accounts within the Gospels to all say the exact same thing, because then we will know that it's actually not accurate. You want to see differences. So whether there was one angel in one account or two angels in another account, it doesn't mean that they're wrong. It means that this eyewitness testimony keyed in on one angel that was talking, and the other eyewitness to the resurrection keyed in on two angels. These are not contradictory testimonies. These are collaborative testimonies. Extra-biblical testimony. Of course, we talked and we read from Josephus and Tacitus and these other examples, and that, but now we also have excruciating testimony. Being that these men, and I believe women as well, died and were tortured and killed for what they knew to be true or false. They knew it. This isn't third generation believers dying for something that they really, really hope is true because of its claims. No, these are people who absolutely knew what was true or false, and they died for that knowledge, for that belief. So again, just to recap here, Yeshua died by crucifixion, undisputed. There was an empty tomb, undisputed. Yeshua's followers believed they had seen him alive and died for that belief, and the changed lives of Paul, Saul, Jacob, James, and Yeshua's brothers as well. And those are the ones that we just are recorded in the Gospels.
I think there's a great story maybe that's a good kind of way to think about this from the apostles' standpoints. Chuck Colson, if you guys know Chuck Colson, he was the Watergate scandal. Chuck Colson was the only person that went to jail for the Watergate scandal. And the reason was because during the prosecution, he actually became a Christian, and he became convicted that he should confess because that was his Christian duty to confess to it. But he says the Watergate scandal was essentially a conspiracy of, you know, a handful of guys, 6 to 10 guys, whatever it was. And they broke into the Watergate Hotel, into the Democratic National Headquarters, communication headquarters, but there wasn't a lot of evidence. And they said, so if we just held tight to the lie, just said we don't know what's going on, they didn't have enough evidence to convict them. And all they were facing was a small amount of time in minimum security prison. And he said, but think, how long did it take for one person to flip and actually testify against everybody? It was like 2 weeks. And he said, John Dean eventually said, you know what, we actually did it, and he testified against everybody else, and that's what broke the whole case open. And he says, think about it. We were faced with basically, a year at most at a minimum security prison, or what he calls club fed. You know, it's not really that bad, minimum security prison. And it only took 2 weeks for somebody to flip. The apostles, the disciples, were faced with persecution and ultimately martyrdom, and all of them, to their dying breath, said the reason we're willing to do this and ultimately martyrs is because Jesus rose from the dead. And yet if they were making it up, one of them would have said, you know what, I didn't sign up for this. You know, I didn't get money, I didn't get sex, I didn't get power. Would have, and yet none of them were willing to do that. And the question he asks is, what's the inference of the best explanation? It seems like it's because they were telling the truth. That's why all of them, to their dying breath, were willing to die for the belief that Jesus rose from the dead, because that's something they would have known firsthand, as David said, was either true or false. And I think that's a great way to think about it. And again, for us, we think that this evidence points to, I think, the overwhelming, inference, the best explanation, that he actually did rise from the dead, which obviously changes everything.
So that's the minimal facts argument, and we would certainly suggest you pick up, if you're really more interested in it, some of Gary Habermas's material. But let's do a 5-minute break, and then we'll be right back here for our last session.